Okay, we're going to pick up with chapter 14 as we continue our look at 2 Kings. We've been looking at the various kings of the northern and southern kingdom of Israel and Judah, and we've been yo-yo back and forth. There's been some ups, been some downs, more downs than ups, and we will continue that tonight as we've been the last several kings we've looked at have actually been of the northern kingdom. Predominantly, and tonight we're going to start off with a look at a guy down in the south by the name of Amaziah. And it says, in the second year of Joash, the son of Jehoahaz, the king of Judah, Amaziah, the son of Joash, the king of Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, became king. So we had two Joashes on the throne at the same time, as we saw last week. And one of them had a son by the name of Amaziah, and he became king when he was 25 years old. And he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was, and this just doesn't sound like a mom's name to me, you know, Jehoiadan. Just sounds like a guy name to me. But his mom's name was Jehoiadan of Jerusalem. And he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, yet not like his father David. He did everything as his father Joash had done. However, the high places were not taken away, and the people still sacrificed and burned incense in the high places. So Amaziah came to the throne around right at the close of the 8th century B.C., generally considered about 796. And he was a pretty good guy. He was says that he did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord, but not quite like David. He wasn't sold out like David. He didn't quite have that heart. It was more like his dad, who had was also a pretty good guy, but didn't get rid of the high places. And so as a result, he ends up with 4.5 stars on the kingometer, and hasn't been since Jehoshaphat that we've had somebody that has rated that high. Amaziah is probably the best king that we've seen since Jehoshaphat. And it says that it happened as soon as the kingdom was established in his hand, that he executed his servants who had murdered his father, the king. If you remember when his dad started going south, there were some guys within the palace who had got together, and they it wasn't a coup. They weren't trying to usurp or overthrow the kingdom. They just simply wanted to get Joash out of the way. And so last week we saw in chapter 12 how they had him murdered. And so the first thing that they had him murdered, and then they say, okay, let's put Amaziah, his son, on the throne. And then Amaziah, the son, says, okay, all you guys that murdered my dad, step over here. And it says that he had them murdered, had them executed. But the children of the murderers he did not execute, according to what was written in the book of the law of Moses, in which the Lord commanded, saying, the fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall the children be put to death for their fathers, but a person shall be put to death for his own son. Now, we know that's what Deuteronomy taught, and we know that that's what he was supposed to do. In fact, the author tells us that. But this would have been really a pretty big step of faith on Amaziah's part. This kind of an action would have been something that would have been pretty much unheard of in that kingdom or in that day and age. You didn't do that. You know, I just see, okay, these guys were guilty. They had committed murder against his dad. But whenever somebody would ascend to the throne in those days, you didn't only kill those guys, but you would kill all of their brothers and all of their sisters and all of their aunts and uncles and cousins whoever taught them in nursery school, and anybody that had been remotely associated with them, you would do away with them too, because you didn't want anybody kind of doing that revenge kinsman redeemer thing, sort of a deal. And so for him to just simply say, this is what the Bible says, so I'm going to do it, and then trust God for the outcome, that's a pretty good step of faith on his part. And you can see that he is really getting off to a very positive first step. And, you know, anytime I see this reference about the fathers are going to answer for their sins, the children won't, and the children will answer for their sins, their fathers won't, I feel, because it's not as big. I actually kind of did a little Googling around on the internet this afternoon and saw that it's still more prevalent than I would like. But this whole deal of generational sins, you may be familiar with that. It was more popular a few decades ago. Whole cottage industry of ministries were raised up to deal with this issue of generational curses and generational sins. And this is the idea that if you got some sort of a problem, whether it would be anger or gluttony or smoking or lust or whatever it would be, it's very likely because somebody in your ancestry, if you go back and look in your pedigree, you can find somebody else who also had that problem. And so it's been passed on to you because the sins of the father are visited upon the third and fourth generation. And you know, really what it is just kind of an excuse to deal with people's carnal behaviors. Well, it's not my fault. I got this demon of fat and ugly. You know, I can't help it. And so, you know, the Bible's very clear about that. It doesn't really, that's not how it works. That's not what the sins of the father being visited to the third and fourth generation is talking about. You know, obviously, if somebody grows up in an alcoholic home, they're going to be in an alcoholic environment, and that's going to have a negative influence on them. And so the sins of the father would be visited upon them. But there's nothing that's either demonically, and obviously demons would be involved in that. You know, they love to keep people messed up. But it's nothing that's demonically transmitted or inherited through the DNA or anything like that. And it says that Amaziah, when he had the kingdom established, it says that he took 10,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. This would be the area that's just south of the Dead Sea, would be the area of Edom. And then he took Selah by war, which most scholars believe that Selah is the name, it's the location of the what's today known as Petra. It's both of these areas are part of Lebanon today. Well, the Valley of Salt's half Lebanon Jordan and half Israel. But the city of Petra, the rock city of Petra that's there in the wilderness is, part of Jordan. And so he took these places, recaptured them, you know, submitted them to Judah's authority, and he changed the name of Selah to a place called Jokthiel, even to this day, whichever that day was when this was written. And then Amaziah sent messengers to Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, the king of Israel, saying, "Let us come face one another in battle." You know, so he kind of sends him a tweet, and he says, "Hey, let's go duke it out." And so Jehoash, the king of Israel, sent to Amaziah, the king of Judah, saying, and he gives him this parable. You know, he's thinking, you know, okay, yeah, so you had this one little victory among the puny Edomites, but check this out. "The thistle that was in Lebanon sent to the cedar that was in Lebanon, saying, 'Give your daughter to my son as wife.'" You know, this would be, you know, the thistle is saying to the cedar, "You're a plant, we're a plant, we're both equal, and so I'm of the same class, the same caliber, I'm of the same social standing as you, so, you know, let me get married to your daughter." And it says, "And a wild beast that was in Lebanon passed by and trampled the thistle. You have indeed defeated Edom, and your heart has lifted you up. Glory in that," Jehoahaz says, "and then stay home. For why should you meddle with trouble that you should fall, you and Judah with you?" You know, so he tweets right back to him and he says, "Hey, you're out of your league here, bub. You know, you might as well kind of mind your own business and don't do something that you're going to be sorry for." And, you know, one of the things about, you know, as we make spiritual application, of course, I think that's the best way of approaching these very real historical stories. But as we, you know, we're not going to battle against our neighbors necessarily or something, but we do wrestle against spiritual principalities and powers. And I think a good way of making application with this is that we should always be on guard that spiritual victories can oftentimes lead us very easily into this place of pride and self-sufficiency. You know, whenever we will have some great spiritual victory, we're involved in something that some sort of a battle, whether it's purely spiritual or it takes place in a physical arena. You know, God uses us and we can just feel the anointing of God. We can feel that he has really given us those words or given us the faith to deal with the situation. And if we're not careful, that can very easily translate into our own self-sufficient pride. And this is what was happening to Amaziah. It says Amaziah wouldn't heed. And so therefore Jehoash, the king of Israel, went out. So he and Amaziah, the king of Israel, faced one another at Beth Shemesh, which belongs to Judah. And Judah was defeated by Israel, and every man fled to his tent. And then Jehoash, the king of Israel, captured Amaziah, king of Judah, the son of Jehoash, the son of Ahaziah, at Beth Shemesh. And he went to Jerusalem and broke down the wall of Jerusalem from the gate of Ephraim to the corner gate, 400 cubits. So that's you know, 600 feet. That's a lot of wallage. And he took all the gold and silver and all the articles that were found in the house of the Lord in the treasuries of the king's house and hostages and returned to Samaria. So, you know, we could say that Amaziah got too big for his loincloth. You know, he was just thinking that he was some stuff. And because the Lord had blessed him in one thing, and he just kind of thought that the Lord would bless him in anything. And that's really not an uncommon phenomenon. I mean, we can probably see it many times as we look at church history or even look at some recent events or even in our own lives. We can see how when the Lord is blessing, it's only a very short journey. It's a very short step whenever the Lord is blessing to begin to think that the Lord will always bless. It's been several decades now, but many of us probably still remember the story about Jim and Tammy Baker and the whole PTL fiasco, and where they had built this very humongous theme park with a hotel and everything there on the East Coast. And what he essentially did was they were selling timeshares in this hotel, and he oversold them, you know, and he sold too much more slots than they had. And so he was convicted and ended up going to jail over the deal. Tammy Faye divorced him. And it was while he was in prison, Franklin Graham began coming to visit him and began ministering to him. And at some point during the journey, he came to an understanding of his error. And he published a book shortly after he got out of jail called I Was Wrong. And it's just a picture of him on the front with, you know, that statement, I Was Wrong, is the title. And he confesses, as part of his testimony in this, is that when they first started off, they didn't have anything, and they were genuine, they were sincere, maybe a little misguided, but they were really wanting to serve God, and it seemed like everything they touched turned to gold. And so it was just a very short step in Jimmy's path to begin thinking that every step he would take would be turned to gold, whether it was something that was good or not. It was just that God was blessing him and backing his every play. And so he began thinking in terms of impunity, that he was just above all of that. And the lure of the grandeur and everything had got a hold of him. And so he confessed that, and it led to his downfall, but in many ways it led to his relationship with the Lord. And I think we can see that a lot with other, like, Christian ministries or even some churches where they get into this mindset. You know, they may be growing and so, you know, it would appear as though God is blessing. And so then they get this, you know, if we build it, they will come mentality. And so they'll go out and they'll do these big pledge drives, and they'll get heavily invested in debt and build this big killer building and everything. And then they have to maintain that. And a lot of charitable parachurch organizations I see kind of go down that same route, where they get bigger than they're equipped for, and then they have to start, God really needs you to support this ministry, and if you don't, it's going to fail, and you don't want that on your conscience. And what started off as a good thing because God had blessed it ends up being... They outgrow themselves. And this is what happened to Amaziah. And it says the rest of the acts of Jehoash, which he did, his might, and how he fought with Amaziah, king of Judah, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? And rhetorical question, I would presume, yes, they are. And so Jehoash rested with his fathers, and he was buried in Samaria with the kings of Israel. And then Jeroboam, his son, reigned in his place. And Amaziah, the son of Joash, the king of Judah, lived 15 years after the death of Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, the king of Israel. And the rest of the acts of Amaziah, are they not written in the book that chronicles the kings of Judah? So we see, you know, we talked about this last week. You got the chronicles of the kings of Israel, chronicles of the kings of Judah, both of which have been lost to us. Now, in 2 Chronicles, the book of 2 Chronicles, which is not the books that I believe are being referenced here in our text, these were written, 1 and 2 Chronicles was probably written a couple of hundred years after this. But in 2 Chronicles 23, we're told that Amaziah actually, after this defeat at the hands of Israel, he actually turned away from the Lord. In fact, it was... essentially, after his victory over the Edomites, he brought back the gods of the Edomites, and he put them into the temple. And he began, as he grew older, he began worshiping these other idols. And, you know, this guy that started off so well, this guy that did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord, he started off so good. And I would accept that he wouldn't destroy the high places, you know, those self-made places of worship that could have taken any kind of a form from the people going to the high place to just simply worship Yahweh to the people going to the high places and erecting these images that they called Yahweh, or the people going to these places and engaging in full-on stomp-down, hope-to-die idolatry. It could have taken any of those forms, but it was a compromise and a departure from the spiritual, truthful worship that God had prescribed for them. And I would suggest that Amaziah's downfall is the direct corollary of him not dealing with the high places, allowing them to continue. We talked quite a bit about this last week because of convenience and everything. And when I look at the, you know, the ecumenical, pluralistic sort of thing that permeates our society today, this whole thing about, you know, we can all just kind of hold hands and make nice. It has had a very devastating effect, I think, on the landscape of the church. And so, you know, even though Amaziah started off real good after we look at his life and everything, I think we probably ought to take at least half of his star away from him. You know, and he started off as a 4.5 guy, which is about as good as you get, really, in the thing of Kings. But we're going to take him away and just make him a 4-star guy. And it says they formed a conspiracy, verse 19, against him in Jerusalem, and so he fled to Lachish. Now, there are a couple of places in the Bible called Lachish. This is a place down in the Negev, down south. And they sent after him to Lachish and killed him there. And then they brought him on horses, and he was buried in Jerusalem with his fathers in the city of David. And all the people of Judah took Azariah, who was 16 years old, and made him king instead of his father Amaziah. You're keeping these names straight, right? Okay, because we're going to have a test at the end of the Bible study. So I want to make sure you... Amaziah was Azariah's daddy. And he built a lot, restored it to Judah after the king rested with his fathers. Now, Eilat is... there's actually a city of Eilat today. And it's the southernmost tip of Israel. It's right there at the very northern point of the Gulf of Aqaba. And the very southernmost part of Israel. And it says that he had rebuilt it and restored it to Judah. And then it says, in the 15th year of Amaziah, the son of Joash, the king of Judah, Jeroboam, the son of Joash, the king of Israel, became king in Samaria. And he reigned a whopping 41 years. And then it says, as we always hear of the northern kings of Israel, he did evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which made Israel to sin. And so Jeroboam II becomes the king of Israel, and the very best that you ever hear said about any of the northern kings is that they did evil in the sight of the Lord because they did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. And so he very closely followed in the steps of his namesake, and so he gets 1.5 stars, because you can be worser than what he was, but he definitely isn't a good guy. And it said that he restored the territory of Israel from the entrance of Hamath, which is, that's an area of what would be today south central Syria. So, you know, just a few miles, maybe 10, 15 miles, 20 miles northeast of Galilee. And he says he restored the territory of Israel. This is Jeroboam II. You know, he's become a king now, still of the dynasty of Jehu. And he restored the territory of Israel from the center southern part of Syria all the way down to the Sea of Arabah, which is the Dead Sea. It's interesting, you know, we've been hearing about the Dead Sea since we were in first grade kindergarten, you know, I mean, or Sunday school. Everybody knows about the Dead Sea. Do you know the word Dead Sea doesn't occur in the Bible? It's never called the Dead Sea in the Bible. It's got many names that it goes by, but they never call it the Dead Sea. And one of its names is the Sea of Arabah. It says he restored all of this. So it, basically all of this Transjordan area that would be Ammon and Moab and even part of Edom that had fallen away from his predecessors, he restored it all back. according to the word of the Lord God of Israel, which he had spoken through his servant. Now check this out. Which he had spoken through his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet who was from Gath-Hepher. You say, is this the same Jonah, the son of Amittai, that we read about that was from Gath-Hepher? Or Gath-Hepher? Yeah, same guy. This is his before fish days, okay? Before he got swallowed, he was a prophet. In fact, this is kind of the era, we could maybe call it, if you could, we could call it the golden age of the Old Testament prophets, except that there wasn't anything golden about it. You know, I mean, the reason why God raised up these prophets is because he had to go tell the people, you're messing up. But there, Hosea, this is the era of Isaiah, Amos, Joel, these guys were all kind of prospering during these days, Jonah. And it says that the Lord, verse 26, saw the affliction of Israel was very bitter, and whether bond or free, there was no helper for Israel. And so the Lord did not say that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. And it was during Jeroboam the Two's reign that Israel was restored to its former borders under Jeroboam the One. Under Omri, you know, it was just, in fact, you'll read some commentaries, some historians that will call the rule of Jeroboam the Second the golden age of the northern kingdom of Israel. They became very powerful. They subjected all of their neighbors to them. Their borders were expanded and very secure. And it was very financially, you can look in archaeology and you can see how financially prosperous the people were during that time. Many people were thinking that happy days are here again. You know, as we'd seen in the previous, his grandfather, father and grandfather and great-grandfather, things didn't go too well, especially with Syria. And their army had shrunk, their borders had shrunk. And people are beginning to think, you know what, now we're back on top once again. And they did prosper very much militarily and financially, but not spiritually. And this is only less than 40 years before the fall to the Assyrians. And so at the time when they thought they were at their greatest strength was when they were setting themselves up for their ultimate fall. And the rest of the acts of Jeroboam and all he did and his might and how he made war and how he recaptured for Israel from Damascus and Hamath, that belonged to what had belonged to Judah. Are they not written in the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? Yes, they are. So Jeroboam rested with his fathers, the king of Israel. And then Zechariah, his son, reigned in his place. So is this the same Zechariah that we know from the Old Testament that wrote the book? No, not the same guy. Several guys in the Old Testament named Zechariah. Only one of them became king, and this would be Jeroboam's son. So now we're going to shift. Okay, that was looking at the northern kingdom of those guys, and so we went through Jeroboam and Zechariah, or mentioned Zechariah. Now we're going to shift back to the south. It says in the 27th year of Jeroboam, the king of Israel, Azariah, the son of Amaziah, king of Judah, became king. So we looked at Amaziah, now we're going to look at his son Azariah. And he was 16 years old when he became king, and he reigned 52 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Jechaliah of Jerusalem. And he did, aren't you glad to see this? I mean, when you see these words, it just sounds so sweet because it's so few and far between that we see them. But it says he did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord, according to all his father Amaziah had done. And you don't want to see a but, or you don't want to see a except after this, but it's there, and it says, except that the high places were not removed, and the people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. Now, another name for Azariah, you may be familiar with Azariah, but the name that he's better known by, that we know him most readily by, is the name Uzziah. And, you know, Isaiah wrote about him in chapter 6 where he says, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord high and lifted up. Well, that's this guy. And so he's the son of Amaziah, and he reigned the longest to date of any of the kings, northern or southern, or even the United Kingdom. He reigned for over 50 years. And, you know, in many ways, he deserves that coveted 4.5 stars on the kingometer. He was a very good king. He was very well loved in many ways. But then Second Chronicles, which gives us a whole lot of insight into the southern kingdom guys. In 2 Chronicles 26, it tells us that he tried to enter the temple. At one point, he got feeling like he needed a bigger loincloth himself. And so he tried to take upon himself the rights of a priest and go into the temple and burn incense. Being a priest was a decision of the Lord. You couldn't just decide, good gig, I think I'll take it. And he presumed upon, in fact, the priest tried to stop him. They said, you can't do that. You know what the book says. You know what the law says. And he says, I'm the king, shut up. And so he did it anyway. And he became stricken with leprosy, as we see in our text. We want to give him the 4.5 stars. He deserved it for a whole lot of the time. But because of that, we're going to take it away and we're going to make him a 4-star king. Also, because it says in verse 5, then the Lord struck the king so that he was a leper until the day of his death, so that he dwelt in an isolated house. And Jotham, the king's son, was over the royal house, judging the people of the land. You know, for every example, and we'll see some as we, when we look at Manasseh, his son. For every example that we see of somebody that starts off bad and then they have some sort of Damascus Road experience that changes their lives, that God gets their attention at the end, for every one of those, for everybody that starts off bad and ends up well, we got 10 guys that start off well and end up bad. I'm not going to say that Uzziah ended up bad, but the consequences of his choices plagued him for the rest of his life. And how many good men and women, how many 4.5-star people do we know that end up living lives of isolation? He lived in an isolated house because he was a leper. You know, he couldn't interact with the people. Even though he was a king, he had to live as an outcast. And how many people do we know, good men and women of God, who have to live in houses of isolation, who would give anything if they could just undo that 15-minute choice that they made the night before, if they could just undo those previous minutes of stupidity. Well, this is where Uzziah/Azariah was. And it says, the rest of the acts of Azariah and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of Kings of Judah? Yes, they are. So Azariah rested with his fathers, and they buried him with his fathers in the city of David, in an isolated tomb, though. He wouldn't be allowed to be put in the same tomb because he was a leper. And so Jotham, his son, reigned in his place. So now we're going to shift back up north. And it says, in the 38th year of Azariah, the king of Judah, Zechariah, the son of Jeroboam, reigned over Israel in Samaria for 6 months. So Jeroboam, the second son, comes to the throne. It says that he did evil in the sight of the Lord, as his fathers had done. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which made Israel to sin. So Zechariah reigns in Israel, and he reigns a whopping 6 months, and he gets that whole standard 1.5 stars that is the best that a northern king seems to be able to accomplish. And it says that Shalom, the son of Jabesh, conspired against him and struck and killed him in front of the people, and he reigned in his place. The rest of the acts of Zechariah, indeed, are they written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings, or they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. So he's not asking if they are here, he's telling us they are. And this was the word of the Lord which he spoke to Jehu, saying, your sons shall sit on the throne of Israel to the fourth generation. And I love this. And so it was. You know, I mean, God said it, and so it was. And so this was Jehu's great-grandson, fourth generation, that had sat on the throne. And then he was killed by this cat named Shalom, the son of Jabesh, and he became king in the 39th year of Uzziah, the son of Judah. And he reigned for a full month. I love that. It doesn't say he reigned for a month. It reigned for a full month. I mean, it wasn't 29 days and, 23 hours. It was the full shebang of the whole full month he reigned. It looks like you would pronounce it Menahem, but it's actually Menachem. Is how you would say it in Hebrew, like Menachem Begin, former prime minister. It says, for Menachem, the son of Gadi, went up from Tirzah, came to Samaria, and struck Shalom, the son of Jabez, in Samaria, and killed him, and reigned in his place. So We got Shalom, and he did just as much bad as he could in the time that he had in that one full month. And he gets his, during that time, 1.5 stars because he still followed the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, in the false worship places. The rest of the acts of Shalom, I don't know how many they could be, but it was a full month. The rest of the acts of Shalom and the conspiracy which he led, indeed, they are written in the books of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. And then from Tirzah, Menachem attacked Tifsah, all who were there, and its territory. And because they did not surrender, therefore he attacked it. And all the women were there who were there, all the women there who were with child, he ripped open. So as he usurped the throne, came to the throne, and commanded that everybody worship him as king, some of the outlying villages didn't accept him as king. And anybody that didn't accept that, he would go in, he would attack the city, and as a show of force, as a way of trying to invoke fear in the hearts and lives of the people, if there were any pregnant women, he would just cut their children out. And we can think, that is just so hideous, that's unconscionable. In fact, I can't even conceive how somebody could do that. Think of this. It all began because these two people ate a bite of a piece of fruit that they were told not to eat. I mean, that's what greased the skids. You know, that's what paved the way. That's the high place that led to this kind of unconscionable depravity. And it says, in the 39th year of Azariah, the king of Judah, Menachem, the son of Gadi, became king over Israel, and he reigned 10 years in Samaria. And he did evil in sight of the Lord, and didn't depart days of the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. And so Menachem becomes king. He reigns for 10 years, and, you know, 1.5 stars. And then it says in verse 19, Pul. Now, with all of these crazy names that we see in the Bible, it's kind of nice, it's kind of refreshing when you come up to some just one syllable, 3 letters, I can pronounce it, I'm probably pretty close to it. I mean, if you were speaking Hebrew or Assyrian or Aramaic or you know, Pig Latin, you probably understand what I'm saying when I say pool, you know. But he wasn't happy with that. You know, I mean, you think, well, I've never heard of Pul, king of Assyria. Well, because that's not his real name. I mean, that's not the name that we know him by. The name that history knows him by is Tiglath-Pileser III. And if you may remember him from world history or some other studies. For some reason, he wasn't satisfied with just being called Pul. And he said, no, I like Tiglath-Pileser III better. And so he came against the land, and Menachem gave Pul 1,000 talents of silver, that his hand might be with him to strengthen the kingdom under his control. So he's thinking, I'm going to buy my support of the Assyrians. The Assyrians were starting to stretch their muscles, and they were becoming very rapidly the king on the hill. And Syria lie between Israel and Assyria. And so Menachem gets this idea, I'm just going to buy him off. And so he gives him 1,000 talents of silver. Now, an Old Testament talent, you know, they vary in weights, but generally speaking, when they speak of talents in the Old Testament, they're going by the Babylonian talent, which was around 70 pounds, maybe just a little less. So by today's weight of price of silver, this would be somewhere in the neighborhood of $13.5 million and $14 million that he gave him, which was a lot of moolah back then. And Menachem exacted the money. Check this out. He exacted the money from Israel, from all the very wealthy, from each man 50 shekels of silver, and then he gave it to the king of Assyria. So they had this time of prosperity where everybody was doing pretty well, and then Jeroboam dies, and then, you know, we're talking like a year later, Menachem's on the throne, and he takes all their money away. And so the king of Assyria turned back, and he didn't stay there in the land. And all the rest of Menachem's acts and everything that he did, aren't they written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? And so Menachem rested with his fathers, and Pekahiah, his son, reigned in his place. So we've got a new dynasty going on now. You know, father passing it on to the son. And in the 15th year of Azariah, the king of Judah, Pekahiah, the son of Menachem, became king over Israel in Samaria, and he reigned 2 years. So we're going from a full month. We're getting up there. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord, and he did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. So, again, Pekahiah is a pretty bad guy, and he gets the same old, 1.5 stars. And then, so we got this Pekahiah guy, and we're trying to get him figured out, but then it says, and then Pekah, so not Pekahiah, but Pekah, the son of Remaliah, an officer of his, so he's like an officer in the army of Pekahiah, Pekah, Captain Pekah, and he conspired against him and killed him in Samaria in the citadel of the king's house, so much for Menachem's dynasty, along with Argob. That is the guy's name, Argob. Now, I know we've had trouble with a lot of, we got, you know, which Joash are we talking about? You know, all of these names that start with A's and J's, and they sound so similar, and I can't keep them all straight. This is the only Argob in the whole Bible. I mean, I would even suggest it's the only Argob ever. You know, nobody would ever have the audacity to name their kid Argob the Second. And if you like Bible names for your kids, this would be a good one. He was killed in the king's house along with Argob and Ariah, and with him were 50 men of Gilead, and he killed him and reigned in his place. And all the rest of Pekahiah, all he did indeed they are written in the Chronicles of Kings of Israel. And then in the 52nd year of Azariah, so this is, you know, Uzziah reigned 53. This is his 52nd year. He's an old guy, getting to the end of his tenure. It says, Pekah, the son of Remaliah, became king over Israel and Samaria, and he reigned 20 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord, didn't depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. So again, we've got Pekah. As with all of his predecessors, he's a bad guy. And it's believed by most scholars that this 20-year reign of his was actually in conjunction with Menachem as a rival king. You know, when he was going around killing Menachem, was killing anybody that didn't accept him, and so it's believed by some scholars that they actually had a dual kingship going on with two different capitals and competing against each other. And his sole kingship was probably just the 8 years between 740 and 732, and he gets 1.5 stars. And then in the days of Pekah, the king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, so he's changed his name from Pul to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and took Ijon, Abel-Meth-Maacha, Janoa, Kadesh, Hazor, Gilead, and Galilee, all of the land of Naphtali, and he carried them captive to Assyria. So the Assyrian captivity has begun. It hasn't, I mean, it just, it's, they're, he's kind of just whittling away at the country now. And then Hoshea, the son of Elah, led a conspiracy against Pekah, the son of Remaliah, and struck him and killed him. We'll learn about Hoshea next time. And he reigned in his place in the 20th year of Jotham, the son of Uzziah. And it's considered by most guys that Hoshea was set up by Tiglath-Pileser III as kind of a puppet. That's the way it is according to the Assyrian records anyway. And the rest of the acts of Pekah and all he did, indeed, they are written in the book of Chronicles of Kings of Israel. Now, there have been 6 kings during Azariah's reign, 6 kings of Israel while Uzziah was on the throne in Judah. And he becomes the 6th one. It says, in the 2nd year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, Jotham, the son of Uzziah, the king of Judah, began to reign. So, okay, finally, Uzziah dies, and his son Jotham comes to the throne. And it says he was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jerusha, the daughter of Zadok. And I love this. He did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord, and he did according to all his father Uzziah had done. Except, however, the high places were not removed. People still sacrificed the burned incense on the high places, and he built the upper gate of the house of the Lord. So we got Jotham in Judah now, and he's a pretty good guy, pretty good king. Of course, Uzziah was his daddy. There was probably a co-regency with them while his dad was living in isolation. And it's generally believed that the 16 years that he was on the throne included that, and that his sole reign would have been between 739 and 735 B.C. And we're going to give him the 4.5 stars because he almost got there, but he didn't take away the high places. But we don't see any, he didn't become a leper or he didn't try to usurp authority or anything like that. So it says the rest of his acts and all he did, are they not written in the Chronicles of the books of Chronicles, Kings of Judah? And in those days, the Lord began to send Rezin, the son of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, against Judah. So Jotham rested with his fathers, and he was buried in the city of David, his father. And then Ahaz, his son, reigned in his place. And in the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, one of the best kings that Israel or Judah has had since David, certainly since Jehoshaphat, Jotham, but then his son Ahaz began to reign. He was 20 years old when he became king. He reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, and he did not do what was right in the sight of the Lord his God, as his father David had done, but he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. Indeed, he made his sons pass through the fire according to the abomination of the nations which the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel. So we got Ahaz in Judah. You know, sounds like we're describing one of the kings of Israel, but we're not. We're describing the king of Judah, and he was very, very bad. In fact, it would appear as though from the text, it says that he made his sons to pass through the fire, and it would appear as though from the text that his naughtiness even surpassed any of the northern kings. In fact, this is the first clear reference that we have. You know, we've seen references to, I believe there was an element of Baal worship that included human sacrifice, and we know that Chemosh and Molech worship of the Ammonites and the Moabites did, but we don't know that if everybody that worshipped those gods engaged in child sacrificing, but it says that he did. And this is the very first clear reference of either kingdom of we have of somebody that did do that. He caused, in fact, Chronicles says he passed, made his sons pass through the fire. So at least two of them. And so he's going to get this is the lowest possible rating on the kingometer. You can't get any lower than a quarter star. Okay, and that's what he gets. Is a quarter star. And he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places on the hills and under every green tree. You know, it was kind of like, I mean, you think there's a church on every corner in the Bible Belt? There was a church underneath every tree in Judah during those days. And it says, Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to make war. And they besieged Ahaz, but they couldn't overcome him. And at that time, Rezin, the king of Syria, captured Eloth for Syria and drove the men of Judah from Eloth. And then the Edomites went to Eloth and dwell there to this day. So Syria was able to capture which is north of Judah quite a bit, was able to even take over the southernmost city of Judah. And it says that Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, saying, I'm your servant and your son. Come up and save me from the hand of the king of Syria and from the hand of the king of Israel and all who rise against me. And Ahaz took silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king house, and he sent it as a present to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria heeded him, for the king of Assyria went up against Damascus and took it and carried its people captive to Kir, and then he killed Rezin. And now King Ahaz went to Damascus, so, you know, Tiglath-Pileser has kind of set up a provincial capital there in Damascus, and Ahaz goes up to check him out, and he saw an altar that was at Damascus, and King Ahaz sent to Urijah, the priest, the design of the altar and its pattern according to all its workmanship. And so he's up at Damascus. He sees this altar that Tiglath-Pileser has erected to the Assyrian's god. He likes it, and so he draws out a picture of it, drop boxes it down to the high priest in Jerusalem in Urijah, and he says, I want you to make one just like this. The world has its way of worshiping, and we want to emulate that to a T. We want to do it just like the world does. And it says that Urijah, who should have said, not going to happen, but it says that Urijah the priest, built the altar according to all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. And so Urijah the priest made it before King Ahaz came back from Damascus. And when the king came back from Damascus, the king saw the altar, and the king approached the altar and made offerings on it. He liked it because it was so worldly, so elegant. And he burnt his burnt offerings and his grain offering, and he poured drink offering and sprinkled the blood of his peace offerings on the altar. And he also brought the bronze altar that was before the Lord, you know, the big bronze altar that had been built. He brought it up, you know, it was just this really great thing that Solomon had built. And he brought that up from the front of the temple, from between the new altar and the house of the Lord, and put it on the north side of the new altar. So he just kind of pushed it over in the corner where it wouldn't be seen, because we got a worldly altar. And then King Ahaz commanded Urijah the priest, saying, on the great new altar, so it's not just simply a new altar, it's a great new altar, burn the morning burnt offering and the evening grain offering and the king's burnt sacrifice and his grain offering with all the burnt offering of all the people of the land, their grain offering, their drink offerings, and sprinkle on it all the blood of the burnt offering and all the blood of the sacrifice. And the bronze altar shall be for me to inquire by. In other words, the bronze altar is just going to be my own little personal kind of divining thing. I'm going to use it. You know, what they would do is they would take animals, cut them open, and then divine by their entrails. You know, they would look at their intestines and somehow be able to tell what the will of the gods were by looking at their guts. And he says, and that'll just be my own little personal divining thing. And thus, Urijah the priest according to all that King Ahaz commanded. And then it says that Ahaz took off the panels of the carts. Remember the bronze carts that when we were studying the construction of the temple, they had these bronze carts that with the little levers in them that they would wheel around. Well, he cut off the panels from them, then he removed the levers from them, and he took down the sea from the bronze oxen that were under it. Remember that big brass basin that had the 12 oxen under it. He took all those off, just kind of dismantled it, and put it on a pavement of stones. And he also removed the Sabbath pavilion. Don't know what that was, but it was just something that had been built extra biblically, which they had built in the temple. Probably some sort of a covering from the sun for the king. But he removed that. And he removed the king's outer entrance from the house of the Lord on account of the king of Assyria. Don't know what that means. And I don't know that anybody else does either. But either making room for the king of Assyria when he come and visit, the king of Assyria told him to do it. We don't know, but he did it on account of him. And it says, the rest of the acts of Ahaz, which he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of Kings of Judah? And so Ahaz rested with his fathers and was buried with the fathers of the city in the city of David. And then Hezekiah, and I'm going to look forward to reading about Hezekiah. It says, Hezekiah, his son, reigned in his place. You know, it was Ahaz was this guy that was always looking for that next thing, that new thing, that next, the temple worship had become blasé and mundane to him. And he went up to Damascus and he saw this was something new. This was cutting edge. This was some really, you know, this had a lot of tech. And he wanted to bring this back to Jerusalem. And he was like so many of us today that are always looking for that latest spiritual buzz, that whatever the new thing that's coming down the pike would be. In fact, Ahaz was really no different. You know, we think of some of the new things that blow through the church, and we think, okay, you'll even hear guys, they'll get up in the pulpit, and they'll say, God is doing a new thing. And the Bible says that. But you know, if you do a search of when it says God is doing a new thing, it's usually not a good thing. You know, it's usually a judgment thing when he does a new thing. But they'll say, God is doing a new thing. And he said, you didn't come here to hear the same old thing, did you? How many here want to hear a new thing? And everybody's all about something new. And we think that that's new, but it's not. In fact, in Acts chapter 17, verse 21, Luke comments, and he's talking about the people in Athens, and he says, for all the Athenians and the foreigners who were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear of something new. And that's what Ahaz was all about. He was all about something new. You know, I don't give me that old-time religion. Give me that new-time religion. Give me something that's going to quiver my liver, give me a buzz. And he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. God, we thank you for these warnings, these exhortations, these examples that we have. And Lord, it really is our desire. Who wants to live in a house of isolation? Who wants to ever be said, we did that which was right in your eyes, however? we did that which was right in your eyes, except. And God, may that never be said of us. May we learn from their mistakes, may we learn from ours, and may we press on to that higher calling in Christ Jesus. And it's in his name we pray. Amen.